going to keep it a little quieter so it's easier for people to hear. And if you wanna tune in, so just unmute yourself. Hopefully you figured out how to do that over the last few months. We have obviously somewhat of an interesting situation this week because on the one hand, this is usually a Parsha class. And on the other hand, the Parsha happens after a very big sort of observance in the Jewish calendar, and that is Tisha B'Av. So I was looking back last year, what we spoke about in Parshas Va'aschanan, and it happens to be, I believe, I was away for it. So we didn't talk about it. And even if we did, it would have been after Tisha B'Av. So that wouldn't necessarily be a relevant discussion, because last year, if you remember, Tisha B'Av fell out on Shabbos, and therefore we observed it on Sunday, which I think meant that Shabbos was Parshas Devarim. Right? Shabbos Chazon is always Devarim, which means that Va'aschanan was 6-7 days after Tisha B'Av. So this year, it's 5 days after Tisha B'Av. It's 5 days after Devarim. And therefore, Va'aschanan is actually only 2 days after Tisha B'Av, which means our class is before both Tisha B'Av and Va'aschanan. So we've got to talk about both of them. That's how at least I'm interpreting it. So I still suffer from what I call kitchen sink syndrome, which is that I always like to talk about everything that's going on, even the kitchen sink. So here we go. We're going to talk a little bit about the Parsha. We're going to talk about the Parsha in a way which I think brings home a message which unfortunately is difficult to sometimes feel, but which I think theologically we have to sort of embrace. There's more to talk about. We'll get there hopefully by the end of the class. I'll start from a very peculiar Gemara which tells us, which is something we talked about last week, which is that there are certain differences about the first four books of the Torah and the last book of the Torah. We talked about the Sefer Devarim in general last week, and how Moshe Rabbeinu recalls many of the things that happened in the first four books, but there are always these little changes, always these little nuances that are always interesting to pick up on that we can learn a lot from. And if we were to hone in on perhaps the greatest, most significant change that Moshe Rabbeinu either makes or recalls, the way he recalls it, is the Aseres HaDibros, right? If I were to ask you, what's sort of the most, coveted part of the Torah, the part of the Torah that we stand up for, whether or not that's justified or not. We talked about that last year from the Rambam, who thinks we shouldn't stand up for that, and the whole Torah is as holy as the rest of it. But either way, you would think that if there's anything you can't change, if there's any of the words of the Torah that cannot be altered, when Moshe Rabbeinu repeats them, you'd think they've got to be the Ten Commandments. And as we know, when we look at them, there are actually a few changes that Moshe Rabbeinu makes. And we'll talk a little bit about today a couple of the different approaches you can take towards understanding that, why it is so different. And we're going to do it through one/two specific examples. But that comes in this week's Parsha. Parshas Va'aschanan has the Ten Commandments, has the Aseres HaDibros. There's a joke that we used to say when we were kids. I don't know why it was so funny, but people used to ask, what color was George Washington's white horse? Right? People know that one? So you can say, you can ask a similar question about the Aseres HaDibros. How many Ten Commandments were there? And the truth is that the answer is not 10. There are many different commandments in the Ten Commandments, and even when you look at the Ten Commandments themselves, this week, some of the actual commandments are different. At least one of them in particular, the mitzvah of not being jealous, the word is changed from lo titaveh to lo techmod, right? They're different words, and they're actually in the codification of the Rambam's mitzvos. When he lists the 613 mitzvos, he actually lists those as two separate mitzvos. Right, so there are really at least 11 commandments that we learn from the Ten Commandments. But the truth is that there are more mitzvahs even within the Ten Commandments. You can break it up into different nuances that we learn from. And therefore, there are many more commandments within the Ten Commandments than just 10. But let's take it step by step from a very small nuance. Perhaps one of the smallest nuances of difference that you can find in the Aseres HaDibros, which I believe we've talked about before in a different context. Maybe it was the Wednesday night class. Maybe it was this class. But either way, the Gemara in Baba Kama has an interesting question. If you look at the first source here, Shaul Rabbi Chanina, if you don't have it, we'll say it outside too. Shaul Rabbi Chanina ben Agil, as Rabbi Yechia bar Abba. He asks, Mipnei ma bedibros harishonos lo nemar bahem tov? Ubedibros haachronos nemar bahem tov? Why is it that when it comes to the first Aseres HaDibros, back in Parshas Yisrael, it doesn't say the word tov? For those who are even more interested, it never even uses the letter tet in the entire first Dibros. I don't know if you know that. There's probably a lot to talk about. I don't remember the discussions offhand. But in the first Dibros, it doesn't say the word Tov. In the second Dibros, it says the words Tov. Who wants to guess? Where exactly? Or maybe you already know. Where exactly does the second Dibros have the word Tov in it? I feel like I've asked this question before. Where in the second time, the second Dibros, does the word Tov come up? Doesn't come up in the first Dibros. It comes up in this week's Parsha, but not when we said it in Yisrael. Anyone know? Any guesses? Anyone that knows? No, nobody.
Well, I read ahead, so I know it's the honor your mother and father.
Where did you read that? Oh, it's in the English. I'm thinking, like, I'm not going to say that at some point, but it's in the English. The Safari database fills in the gaps there and tells you where it is. Right when it says, Kabeda Savicha Vyasimecha, so it says, honor your father and your mother. And in the first time, in Parsha Yisro, the first Aseres HaDibros say, Leman Yarichun Yamecha, so that your days will be lengthened. Right, you honor your parents, your days will be lengthened. What exactly that means is open for interpretation. Here's a rational approach, which some people here might appreciate. If you take care of your parents, so they'll make sure that you're healthy. Right? If you take care of your parents, so then they'll take care of you. And they'll raise you properly, and they'll give you the resources, and right, etc. That'll give you long life. That's just a simple way to understand it. But there are obviously more spiritual ways of understanding what it means to have a long life too. However, when it comes to this week's parasha, when it comes to Parshas Va'aschanan, it doesn't only say "Kabeidus Avich Aviasimecha Leman Yarichun Yamecha," but then it adds a phrase. It adds a phrase "Leman Yarichun Yamecha Uleman Yitavlach," so that will also be good for you. Now, what exactly does that mean? It'll be good for you, right? It'll lengthen your days, and it'll also be good. What's going to be good? Doesn't exactly explain what that means. There are other Ma'amarei Chazal that explain what that means. But on a pshat level, why would we need to add specifically those words the second time around? Right? So the Gemara asks, why is it that the second Dibros have the word Tov, whereas the first ones didn't? Why did we add those words? It's also interesting that the phrasing of the question almost extrapolates from it. It doesn't really combine it to that to Kibud Av V'Em. It doesn't even talk about specifically honoring your father and your mother. Really just says, why are the Ten Commandments, why do those include the word Tov? As if it's sort of, you know, an independently significant aspect of the Ten Commandments in general, and not specifically about Kavidus Avicha V'Asimecha, which is an interesting point for a different time. So what's the answer? If you thought that question was peculiar, so listen to the answer. And it goes through even more peculiar things where there's a Tana or an Amora that says, well, before you ask me why there's a difference, ask me if there's a difference, because I don't remember where the difference is, right? That's what the Gemara says. What exactly that means is the whole discussion. But then it says this, Kach Amar Li Shmuel Bar Nachum Achi Imo Shel Rabbi Acha B'Rabbi Chanina. So this is what one person said, or V'Amri La, some people say it was from this person, Avi Imo Shel Rabbi Achi B'Rabbi Chanina. And he said the reason it doesn't say the word Tov in the first Aseres HaDibros is because the last three words of the first source, Hoil v'sofan lehishtaber, because in the end of the day, Hashem knew that those luchos, those first tablets, were going to be broken. And therefore, Hashem didn't want the word Tov to be on a broken tablet. Now, there are so many things to talk about in this phrase. First of all, well, if Hashem didn't want it to happen, so then why did he make it happen in the first place? Secondly, what does it mean that they're not in the first Dibros? When did Hashem talk to the Aseres HaDibros? Hashem said it verbally, right? Whatever that means, verbally, right? He spoke it out. It wasn't just on the stones. So maybe he could have said it and then written it differently. So there are interesting questions about this. But what we find here is, in sort of a cryptic phrase, Hashem didn't want the goodness, the word Tov, to be broken after we know the Aseres HaDibros were going to go down when Moshe threw them down. They were going to go down the mountain and break. Actually, not just break, but be decimated, right? The word is Vayishaber, right? Vayishaber is different from Lishbor. For those who are familiar with Hebrew grammar, which I'm not, so I just happen to know a couple things. But Lishbor would mean to break, like you break something in half. But Moshe Rabbeinu was Mishaber. Mishaber means to completely obliterate. The Luchos were completely obliterated, which is, you know, which is obviously more dramatic. It wasn't just that they broke. I don't remember how the movies depict it, but it wasn't just that they broke in half into a couple pieces. He literally just completely pulverized them. So what's interesting, one simple observation that we can take from here, a simple observation which is not necessarily true according to all opinions, and it would have to be disagreeing with this Gemara, is that the first Luchos that Moshe Rabbeinu brought down were different than the second Luchos that Moshe Rabbeinu brought down. Now, that seems to be obvious based on our Jewish day school education that they were different because we have the first set of Ten Commandments in Yisro and we have the second set of Ten Commandments in Va'eschanan. We just assume, possibly based on this Gemara, that the two were different. One was before the Egel Azav and one was after, which is definitely true, but that has somehow they changed in between. That the first Aseres HaDibros had this set of words in Parshas Yisro, and the second Aseres HaDibros had this set of words, different set of words. So, and some people say that's not how it happened. I think the Ibn Ezra maybe says that when Moshe Rabbeinu says the Aseres HaDibros in this week's Parsha, it was just his paraphrasing of the Aseres HaDibros. Whereas the words themselves were always the same, but Moshe's retelling of it was different. So that's a little bit harder to work into the Gemara, because the Gemara says the first one didn't have the word Tov, and the second one did. So, and the first one broke, and it would have broken with it. So that's sort of an interesting question for the Ibn Ezra. How do you figure that one out? If I remember correctly, I think it was the Ibn Ezra. So what does this Gemara mean? What does this Gemara mean? And we have to think about what possible lessons can we learn from that. So first of all, let's look into the Aseres HaDibros. We'll do a little bit of an activity together, and this is going to require some interaction. Give my voice a little bit of a break here. We're now going to look at sources 2 and 3 together, okay? Now, there's one glaring difference, but I want to point out, see how many people, you know, what differences we can point out between sources number 2 and number 3, just as a little bit of an exercise in noticing these changes. So sources number 2 and source number 3 are depicting Shabbos, right? They're talking about Shabbos. These are exactly the words of first our Parsha this week, Va'eschanan, and then the Parsha in Yisro. So number one, the Pasuk tells, in source number 2 it says, Shamor es Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho. Let's do it like this. I'll read source number 2, and people can look on source number 3 and notice any differences. So the Pasuk Yud Beis in this week's Parsha in Perek Hay says, Shamor es Yom HaShabbos L'Kadsho, Kasher Tzivcha Hashem Elokecha. Any differences? What do we have so far? Okay, for the last four words are different. There's no kasher tzivcha shem lokecha.
The first word is different.
Right? And the Reina says the first word is different. Good, the first word is also different. The first word is shamor versus the first word in Yisro was zachor, which is a very important difference for a lot of halachos that we learn. And then as Adina pointed out, the last four words of the pasuk are also different. Kasher tzivcha shem lokecha. This is probably because Moshe Rabbeinu was talking. Now this supports in some ways what the Ibn Ezra said, right? The Ibn Ezra is saying this is just Moshe Rabbeinu reporting what Hashem did. So kasher tziv Hashem l'kacha means as Hashem spoke to you. Okay, let's keep going. Sheshes yamim ta'avod v'asisa kol melachtecha. That seems to be exactly the same in sources number 2 and number 3. But then we continue. V'yom hashvi shabbos l'Hashem l'kacha lo sasa kol melacha ata Uvbincha, uvitecha, v'avdecha, v'amasecha, v'shorcha, v'chamorcha, v'chol v'hemtecha, v'gercha shebishirecha, l'man yanuach avdecha v'amascha kamocha. What are the differences? What are the differences between Pasuk Yud Dalet and Pasuk Yud in Source 3? What do we have?
The whole last part is different.
Again, a tag on the end. Leman yanuach avdech v'amascha kamocha. So that your servant and your maidservant can rest along with you. An interesting phrase that's not in the first time. Although it is implied in the first time because it says, avdech v'amascha. They should also not do work. So what is the addition? What's the benefit of adding that line? Leman yanuach avdech v'amascha kamocha. They should also rest. What exactly does that mean? Okay, there are also a couple interesting nouns that were left out in source number 3, that weren't in the original from Parshas Yisrael. Now let's keep going. Probably the biggest difference, and this one no one has to point out because the psukim are completely different. If you look at source number 2, Pasuk Tesvav says, V'zacharta, and you shall remember, Ki eved hayisa be'eretz Mitzrayim, you were a slave in Egypt, Vayotzi acha Hashem elokach misham, and Hashem took you out of that place, Biyad Chazakah Bizrao Nutuya, with a strong hand and outstretched arm. Al Kain, therefore. That's always good when the Pasuk says therefore, we know exactly what the reason for something is. Al Kain Tzivcha Hashem Elokech La'asos Es Yom HaShabbos. Therefore Hashem gave you Shabbos. What does it mean, therefore? He gave you Shabbos because of what came before it. Because he took you out of Egypt. What's the only problem with that is that in source number 3, the first time we heard about Shabbos, that was nowhere to be found. If you look in Pasuk Yud Aleph in source number 3, Kishesh es yamim asa Hashem es hashamayim ves haaretz es hayom es kol hashavam, nothing about Mitzrayim here, vayanach bayom hashvi'i, and he rested on the seventh day, al kain, there it is, therefore. That's why Hashem gave you Berach Hashem as Yom Shabbos Vayikad Shehu. He gave you the day of Shabbos and sanctified it. So when it comes to source number 2, our Parsha, the reason for Shabbos is because we were slaves and God took us out of slavery in Egypt. The reason for Shabbos in source number 3 back in Yisrael is because Hashem created the world and rested on the seventh day. Now, obviously, both the creation of the world and the Exodus are significant groundbreaking events in human history. Both of them require their own focus and emphasis in other mitzvahs. We've seen it before. But why would Hashem / Moshe Rabbeinu, when depicting Shabbos, give completely different reasons? He knows that the Luchos say something else, or he knows that Hashem had said something else, or Hashem obviously knows that the first Luchos said something else. And nonetheless, we have a different reason. Why would the reason for Shabbos be different when it comes to Yisrael versus when it comes to this week's Parsha of Aschanan? Any suggestions? Any thoughts before we see the Ramban? Why would Shabbos be depicted back in Yisrael in terms of the creation of the world? And why would Shabbos now in Vayeschana be depicted in regards to framed by the leaving, the exodus from Egypt, God saving us from Egypt? Any takers, any suggestions? I mean, this is pretty foundational stuff. This is the Aseres HaDibros. He changed the reason on us. Why did he do that? Yeah, Reina.
Does it have something to do with the fact that this is 40 years later?
Okay, what do you mean?
I don't know. Okay. Just
so if you're going to say the reason of 40 years later, you'd have to assume that this is not what's on the Luchos, right? Because the Luchos were given 40 days later, right? When Moshe Rabbeinu goes back up the mountain on Har Sinai, he goes back up on Rosh Chodesh Elul to write the Luchos again. So something must have changed in between that caused the Luchos to be different. If that was the case, you're saying that maybe this is according to the Ibn Ezra, just Moshe Rabbeinu's paraphrasing of it later. And if that's the case, so yeah, then you might be right that it has something to do with the 40 years in the desert. What exactly that one would, how one would necessitate the other, is an interesting question also. But let's assume for now, based on the Gemara that we saw in Bava Kamma, that these were actually both phrases that were mentioned on the Luchos, that Luchos number 1 and Luchos number 2 were different even within the 2 months of each other. Anyone else? Aviva.
Following up what Raina said, it doesn't doesn't answer the question of how is are they really different in the writing, but there is a different emphasis, and you know, with the Yetzias Mitzrayim,
right?
That everything was dependent on Hashem and the creation, and Hashem was the was in charge of all of nature, and then here, where they're on the verge of becoming self-reliant, mm-hmm. then it's not just enough to focus on Hashem having created the world, but also that mm-hmm. even though they will rely on their own actions, still Hashem is still behind it.
Okay, okay, we'll see the Ramban in a second that echoes that kind of idea. So good.
Probably I echo the Ramban.
Okay, or the words of the Ramban sound a lot similar to what Aviva is saying. We'll see that in a second. First of all, let's keep in mind that we're in a moment in the Jewish calendar which is literally deciding between the first and second Lukos, right? We know that Shiva Asar B'Tammuz is 2.5 weeks ago, told us that that was the day where the Luchos were broken. That's the day where Moshe Rabbeinu came down and broke the Luchos, was on the 17th of Tammuz. And therefore, that puts us in the moment of the 9 days, obviously, but it also puts us in the moment where Moshe Rabbeinu is outside of the camp contemplating the fate of the Jewish people and what he's going to do for the Jewish people, right? He's protesting what they did. And therefore, it's particularly poignant for us to sort of focus what happened between the first Luchos and the second Luchos. Why is there such a difference? So Aviva just told us, and the Ramban is about to tell us, a very interesting idea, that it has really nothing to do with what's gone on, because it's a very short time period between the two, right? Between the first Luchos and the second Luchos is only a few weeks, and therefore it would be somewhat of a big, you know, chiddush to say that so much has changed that they should change, that Hashem would want to change Luchos already. So if you look at the Ramban in source number 4, he says the following. V'ha-ra-u-yoter, what seems to be most fitting, where he quotes other people before, and is in great Ramban style, the predecessor of every thesis paper nowadays. He tells you what everybody else says and tells you why he doesn't think they're right. And then he says his own thing, right? So here's the Ramban saying, V'ha-ra-u-yoter lomar, what's more fitting is to say the following. Ki ba'avor hayos yitzias Mitzrayim more al eloka kadmon. Yetzias Mitzrayim, the exodus from Egypt, also taught us about who the creator of the world was. Originally, Mechadesh Chefetz, he's someone who constantly creates new things, V'yachol, and is able to do so. Kasher Parash B'dibur HaRishon, as he said back in Yisro, this is on this week's Parsha, Al Kain Amar Bekan, therefore he says here, Im Yala B'libcha Safik, maybe you might have doubts. Maybe you might think, Al HaShabbos HaMorah Al HaChiddush VaHaChefetz VaYecholes. Maybe you would think, because of Shabbos, there's some kind of doubt about Hashem's creation of the world, that He can still do things. Tizkor Ma'ashero Einecha B'Yetzias Mitzrayim. You have to remember what Hashem did for you in Egypt. Shehi L'cha L'raya U'L'Zecher. That this should stand for you as a proof and as a reminder. Hine Hashabbos Zecher Yetzias Mitzrayim. That is to remind you of Egypt. V'Yetzias Mitzrayim Zecher Shabbos. And Egypt was a reminder of Shabbos. What does that mean? That we're supposed to remember that Hashem is the ultimate creator, the one who can continuously create new things, not just originally, but continually going forward. And therefore, says the Ramban, it's not only the case that Hashem created the world originally, but it's also the case that he continues to do so and intervening in the world. So what does that mean? Right? I don't know if people are familiar with the philosophical claim in terms of God's existence, but it's called the watchmaker theory. People familiar with the watchmaker theory? That God created the world and then stepped away from it. Right? He put it, he wound it up and then just let it run. Right? So says the Ramban, there are two aspects of God's creativity in the world. There are two aspects of Hashem being the one who controls the world. It doesn't just mean that he created it at one point and then went and stepped away from it, but rather what it means is he created it and then he's watching over it. He's intervening with it. He's making sure a plan is followed through with. So here it says the Ramban, that's the two-sided coin that Hashem is creating between the first and the second luchos. The first luchos are about Hashem's creation of the world. Unless you think that Hashem's creation of the world ended with day seven, and therefore he rested and he rested for all time, you also have to remember on Shabbos that Hashem brought you out of Egypt. Because it wasn't just that he rested on the seventh day and did nothing else to the world. He rested on the seventh day and then he watched and continued to create, continued to intervene, continued to make sure things went as planned when it came to the rest of the world history as well. V'yomru Hashem, says the Ramban in the last line, ki yizkru v'yomru Hashem hu mechadish b'chol osos umosim v'osa b'chol kortzono. And he does everything constantly. He does everything as he wills it. He's the same one. He's the same Hashem who did the original creation. So says the Ramban, why is there a difference between Luchos number one and Luchos number two? It's not really a difference. It's emphasizing two sides of the same coin, which is that Hashem is the creator of all things, not only in the past, but also in the present and in the future. Right, Hashem Malach, Hashem Melech, and Hashem Yimloch Liyov Vad. He's always watching over. He's always controlling what's going on behind the scenes. He's not just a watchmaker. And that's really the two sides of the same idea. It's not a separate idea. It's not really a change as much as it is a different focus. But the truth is that I think there's another explanation or another approach as to the difference between Luchos number one and Luchos number two. And in order to understand that, I want to sort of go on a tangent, not necessarily a tangent, but focus on what we had mentioned in source number one. And there are different ways you can go about this, and we'll hopefully tie it back in to the differences of Shabbos. But first, let's take a step back and understand, what does it mean, the word Tov? What does the word Tov mean? Now, the word Tov obviously translates to good. Good means, you know, positive things. But what does it mean in terms of its implications? What are the implications of something being good? So for that, let's look at one of the earliest instances of Tov, which people always like to talk about. And that is when God created Chava. When Hashem creates Chava, what does he say? Right? He sees Adam, he's just wandering around, and he says, Lo tov hayos ha'adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone. What does that mean, it's not good for man to be alone? More specifically, if we were to sort of backtrack and think about those words for a second, what does it mean that Hashem thinks it's not good for man to be alone? It's interesting phrasing, because Hashem knows the word bad, right? If it was really a bad thing, so Hashem would have said it's bad for man to be alone. Not only that, but he does so pretty soon after when it comes to the Dor HaMabul. Right? When it comes to the end of Bereshis, Hashem doesn't hold back. He says, man is rotten from his beginnings. Rami nu'arav, man is doing terribly. Right? He says that. So why does Hashem use the phrasing lo tov? Right? If it's bad for man to be alone, so then he should have used the word bad. Why does Hashem say lo tov? It's just not good. And this is in no way a criticism or judgment on getting married or anything like that, chas v'shalom. But what does it mean, lo tov? This goes into the importance of relationships in general. What does the word lo tov mean? So the Kli Yakar has an unbelievable, to me, I find this an unbelievable insight, which I think is so important. And, well, I guess let's just read it. The Kli Yakar says, v'yesh omrim lo tov, she'ein ha'adam nikra osei tov, b'mitzvos Hashem yisparach kishehu levado. If a person does mitzvos and he's by himself, so then he's not called an osei tov. What does that mean, he's not called an osei tov? He's doing mitzvos. Isn't that a good thing? Says the Kli Yakar, kishehu levado ve'ein lo mitnaged. There's nothing opposing him. Now, we can take this in different ways. But I like to take this in terms of, you know, the same way that we understand the words Esa lo Ezer Kenegdo, that there is a woman who is going to be helpful to him, which is opposite him. What does it mean, opposite? It doesn't mean trying to work against him, but it means someone who is opposing you at every step. There's something that you have to work with somebody else, meaning you can't just do what you want. Yeah, Aviva, before we move on.
Is that something like a malach is not tov because there's nothing, he has no other option.
Good. So exactly.
Their needs are hurrah, but that's, and the person has to overcome that or has to.
Good. Perfect. Tov. Yes, perfect. And there was a source that I was going to include on the source sheet about the Yetzer Hara, but we'll just say it outside in a second when we get there. So Aviva is telling us that a malach, as we know, a malach is sent on a mission by Hashem. And a malach is not rewarded for that mission because a malach just does what he's supposed to do. He has no free will. A malach doesn't have, as a messenger of Hashem, he's given a very specific task and he does the task. There's no possibility for him to do anything else. Says the Kli Yakar, when a person is by themselves, they have nobody else to work with, nobody else to have to compromise with. There's no other schedule that they have to work with and make sure that they're not impinging on their own activities, right? When there's nobody else there, so then it can't be called an osei tov. Whatever you're doing is just what you do. There are no repercussions. There are no consequences to doing something wrong. And if there's no possibility of doing something wrong, then there's no possibility of doing something right. Right, you can't be called an osei tov if there's no possibility of being an osei ra. If anything that you do is just what you do, and it doesn't create any negative consequences for another person, so then you can't create positive consequences either. You just do what you do. Let's bring it into a sort of a more common analogy. Let's say you're, and I usually use basketball, but let's keep the sports references out. Let's say you enter into an art competition. So let's say you enter into an art competition with, I don't know, Van Gogh, right? And you and Van Gogh are going at it, and you're making a piece of art, he's making a piece of art. If you win that contest, so that's a big accomplishment. You would call that pretty good. I mean, that is pretty unbelievable, right? You get awards, you get a trophy, you get something for winning that contest. Let's change the game. Let's say you're in an art contest with a kindergartner. My son is at that stage where he's drawing a lot of pictures, Baruch Hashem. He's enjoying it, and it keeps him occupied. But if I were to draw a picture, and he were to draw a picture, so no one would say that I did a good job if I drew a better picture. Of course I drew a better picture. There's no possibility. It wasn't even an option that I was going to lose. Of course I would draw a better picture than a kindergartner. Hopefully people are at least good enough to draw pictures better than kindergartners, but either way, you get my idea, which is that when there's no possibility, it's not even an option to lose, so you wouldn't get a trophy for winning, right? You wouldn't get a trophy. I think I mentioned a story once with a basketball coach who was asked, were you impressed that your player did this well? You know, he had a good game. And he said to the reporter, he said, what do you mean he had a good game? That's why I got him on the team. The reason I offered him a scholarship to come to our school for free was so that he could have a good game. If he doesn't have a good game, then we have a problem. But the whole point is that that's what he's supposed to do. Now, obviously, you have to, you know, think about the methodology and strategy and coaching players, and whether that was a good decision or not is, you know, probably of a different era about how to deal with motivation and things like that. But either way, if there's no possibility, if there's no tension, there's no issue with what you're trying to deal with, so it's not going to be particularly rewarding or particularly positive or good if you overcome nothing, right? You can only be good if there's a possibility of bad. And that's what the Kli Yakar says here in Source number 5. Ein lo misnagin hamateu l'derech ra, that could cause you to do other things, specifically evil things or the wrong things. L'fikach esa lo ezer kenegdo, ki b'ma shetiyah ishto, from the fact that she's going to be Adam's wife, kinegdo lahasito l'derech ra, it gives him the opportunity to do things wrong. V'hu lo yishmala, and maybe he has to sort of stay away from listening to her or doing things specifically in terms of eating the fruit. V'natzcha az hu nikra osei tov, if he overcomes the desires, overcomes the inclinations to do the wrong thing, then he can be called an Oseh Tov. Ki Adam ein tzadik ba'aretz k'shiaseh tov mitzad ha'achreyach v'lo yuchal lechto. It's really a beautiful drash that he's making based on a pasuk we've quoted before from, was it from Mishlei or Kohelis? From David HaMelech, he says, ein tzadik ba'aretz k'shiaseh tov v'lo yachta. We've talked about it in different ways, a lot of drashas to be made from it, but he's basically, the Kli Yakar is saying, no one is called a tzaddik unless they have a possibility to sin. You're not righteous if you don't have a possibility to sin. If you just do what you do, if you're just you happen to be a goody-good, you have no inclination to sin, so you're not going to get any brownie points for doing what you're naturally accustomed to doing. Ki im mitzad hayosla efsharut al hachet v'inatzel. It's only when you have the possibility to sin that you can actually be rewarded for doing better. There's an interesting Mishnah just on the same point. The Mishnah tells us in Avos, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai kibbel mehillel meshameh hu haya omer. He used to say, im lamadta Torah harbe al tachzik tov al atzmecha. If you learned a lot of Torah, don't think you're so great, because lekach notzarta. That's why you were created. You weren't created to not learn Torah. You were created to learn Torah. Now, obviously, that's a little bit of a harsh message, especially when we have so many other things to do in life. But the point is that when a person is meant to do something, when there's not another option, so it is not going to be called Tov. It's not going to be something which is rewarded. It's not going to be something which is particularly impressive because you had nothing working against you. There's an interesting Gemara that tells us in Kiddushin. This is back to Aviva's point that she mentioned earlier. The Hashem tells us, this seems to be at odds with other Gemaras, but we'll leave those aside for the moment. Barasi Torah, Barasi Yetzirah, Barasi Torah Tavlin. Hashem created the Yetzirah. He created the evil inclination, and then He gave us the Torah to outweigh that evil inclination. Meaning that when Hashem gave us the possibility of sin, He gave us at the same time the antidote to that sin. He gave us the Torah, which is going to be something which is rewardable, which is something which is good, or something when you follow it, it is considered to be positive and impressive, that you did something, that you accomplished something, right? It was only because of the Yetzirah that we even got the Torah. So what does that mean for us? What does that mean for us in terms of the first Gemara? The first Gemara that we saw in source number one said that, interestingly enough, the first Aseres Hadibros don't have the word Tov in them. Only in the second Aseres Hadibros they have the word Tov. Why would there be such a difference? Why would there be the word Tov only the second time around? And what we've learned, what we've noticed, or what we've noted, is that something happens between the first and the second Dibros, which is obviously earth-shattering. Not only earth-shattering, but luchel-shattering. Right? The Egel Hazav itself. The Jewish people worship an idol. What exactly did they have intention for the idol to be? The leader of the Jewish people, was it a replacement for God, a replacement for Moshe? Whole discussion, not for now. But in the end of the day, what did the Jewish people show Hashem? The Jewish people expressed, obviously Hashem knew this, but he was trying to get the message across, that the Jewish people expressed the fact that they are fallible beings. Even after Hashem took them out of Egypt, even after all the miracles, even after the splitting of the sea, even after the water and the giving them clothing, giving them food, even after all of that, the Jewish people could still fall to such a low of worshiping a golden calf. Even after all of that. So the expression the Jewish people gave to Hashem was, we can sin. That we have issues, we can make mistakes. And it's specifically in response to that reality, to the reality that the Jewish people are not a perfect people, to the reality that the Jewish people are not going to just keep the Torah the way that it was meant to be kept, but rather are sometimes going to make mistakes. In reality of that, in reaction to that reality, Hashem gives them another Aseres Hadibros. He gives them the second Luchos. This time around, however, it's a different type of set of commandments, as opposed to the first one, which was just what they were supposed to have done, right? It was supposed to be who the Jewish people were. The Jewish people were supposed to be this pristine, as they say in America, the house on the hilltop or whatever they call it, right? It's supposed to be this perfect, picturesque, you know, people that never sin, they never make mistakes, they were just going to do the Torah the way that Hashem wanted them to do the Torah. They were just going to have a sort of a utopic lifestyle, keeping in line with the Torah. They were going to go into Eretz Yisrael right away. They were going to make a Beis HaMikdash right away. Everything was going to be great. And lo and behold, it didn't work out that way. The Jewish people showed Hashem and showed all of us that people make mistakes. And within that construct of a people that can make mistakes, Hashem gives them a new Aseret HaDibros. He gives them a new Torah, a Torah which includes within it the possibility of making mistakes. And that's why only in the second Aseret HaDibros does the word Tov come up. This is not necessarily my own idea. I happen to have said it. I happen to have thought of it, but I saw that Rav Eliyahu Dessler had brought it into the world before me, using the concept of the Kli Yakar, which is that the second time around, the Aseret HaDibros used the word Tov, used the word good, specifically because the Jewish people have now expressed that they can make mistakes. Just as Adam HaRishon is not considered Tov while he's by himself. Lo Tov Hayos Adam Levado. As long as the Jewish people were in their pristine state and there was no possibility of doing anything wrong, they were so close to Hashem through all the makos, through all the miracles he did, so there was no possibility of doing anything good. Anything that they did is just what they were supposed to do. But once they sinned, once they did the Egel Azav, once they committed possibly the act of Avodah Zarah, so then they showed Hashem that keeping to the Torah is not only something that we're going to struggle with, but it's something that if we struggle and then overcome, it'll be called good. Because now they show that there's a possibility of bad. There's a possibility that they can make a mistake. There's a big mistake. And therefore Hashem says, well, in that case, this time around, I'm going to put in the word Tov. Because now that I know you can make mistakes, so then it is Tov if you're going to overcome them. And if we go back to sources number 2 and number 3 about Shabbos, we'll notice something very interesting. We'll notice, first of all, the difference, number 1, of Shamor and Zachor. What's the difference of Shamor as Yom HaShabbos and Zachor as Yom HaShabbos? Zachor means to remember. What does remembering do? Remembering is not something that you do right now. It's something that you recall from the past. Zachor means you remember what Hashem did. So in terms of Shabbos, there's no real interaction between the person and the day of Shabbos. All we do on Shabbos, based on source number 3, based on Parshas Yisro, is that we remember what Hashem did. We remember what Hashem did because we don't have necessarily a connection with it anymore. There's nothing that we have to do in particular. So that's why it has the word Zachor, we remember. And then it also says that Hashem created the world in the 7 days of creation. Because it's all about the nature of the day. The nature of the day is such that we should be doing these things. We shouldn't be working because the nature of the day is such. However, after the Egel Hazav, after we showed Hashem that we can actually make mistakes, we can make big mistakes. So Hashem changes the reason for Shabbos. Or at least he adds a reason for Shabbos. That it's not just about Hashem's creation of Shabbos, but it's also how do we relate to Shabbos? How do we relate? Because the Aseret HaDibros is all about the human aspect. So what is that we have to do? Shamor. We have to guard Shabbos. We have to make sure that we're doing our part to not violate Shabbos. That's our part. That's the human aspect of it. We have to hold ourselves back. Shamor, as we know, is a reference to not violating something. And that's our job. Right, that's exactly what Hashem is saying. After you did the Egel Azav, now you have to be careful. Now you have to show restraint. Hold yourself back from doing certain activities on Shabbos. Now these activities already existed in order to recognize Hashem's creation of the world, but now it has the human interaction. Now it comes back to the human reality. How is it that we relate to it on a human element? Because something specifically, as the Ramban said, expresses Hashem's dominion over the world in regards to something we did. What is something that we went through that Hashem also showed his control over the world by something that we had a relation with? That was our experience in Egypt. Hashem took you out of Egypt, and it was through that experience that you personally, in your human experience, we're able to recognize Hashem's dominion over the world. Not just something that happened long ago that we'll just expect you to relate to, but rather something that you yourselves were involved in. The human element that you can relate to and you can be motivated by. If you look at source number 7, so the Rambam tells us the following. Two different reasons in the guide for the Reflex, the Mor Nevuchim. Two different reasons are given for this command because of two different objects. This difference can easily be explained. Great Maimonidean fashion. Very easy to explain this one. In the former, the cause of the honor and distinction of the day is given. Therefore, the Lord hath blessed the day of Sabbath and sanctified it. But the fact that God has given us the law of the Sabbath and commanded us to keep it is the consequence of our having been slaves. For then our work did not depend on our will, nor could we choose the time for it, and we could not rest. Thus God commanded us to abstain from work on the Sabbath and to rest for two purposes. Namely, number one, that we might confirm the true theory, that of creation, which at once and clearly leads to the theory of the existence of God. We first and foremost recognize Hashem created the world. Second, that we might remember how God has given in freeing, has been, how kind God has been in freeing us from the burden of the Egyptians. The Sabbath is therefore a double blessing. It gives us the correct notions about God and also promotes the well-being of our bodies. Meaning that's how we relate to it. Well-being of our bodies is a very interesting phrase. And I think the way that I think of it is when you think about, you know, exercise, when you think about lifting weights, when you think about doing something difficult, right? When we put strain on our body for the sake of building muscle, so it hurts and sometimes it's difficult, but it's good for us. Right? So Hashem, now the way that the Rambam is saying it about Shabbos is that our refraining, our restraint, our not doing things, even though we want to do things, is good for us. Right? That is in some ways in recognition of what we used to do in Egypt. We had to do all these things at all times. We had no control over what we did, but we were always doing things. And so too, when it comes to Shabbos, we remember that those times were times where we couldn't hold ourselves back, and we can now hold ourselves back. It's good for us to take that rest. You can understand in different ways also, but that's how I choose to understand it. And therefore, what we see is, in general, the second dibros that we find this week's Parsha, the second dibros are all about the human reality. They're all about how people are fallible, people can make mistakes, and therefore we have a Torah that allows us not only to rectify those mistakes, but to do good. By not making those mistakes, we're actually doing good. And I think in sort of, if we zoom out even more, what we find is that oftentimes we find that Hashem gives us challenges. Hashem gives us, you know, tests. And sometimes they're very difficult. And sometimes we don't necessarily understand them. But within that challenge, within that test, is something that can build our muscle, right? He gives us barbells so that we can lift them up, right? And it's very difficult to do so. But the same thing, when Hashem creates Shabbos, He creates it in a way that challenges us to keep it. Shamor es yom haShabbos l'kadsho. When you're able to follow Shabbos and appropriately observe and guard Shabbos, so then you will sanctify it. It will be good. Right? When you are kabed es avicha v'simecha, when you properly honor your parents, even though sometimes it might be difficult, especially for the sandwich generation, right? If it's difficult, so then you'll be able to not only l'man yarichun yomecha, but l'man yitav lach, it'll be good for you. It'll be good when you're able to accomplish that mitzvah. And I think when we think about the 9 days, and we think about Tisha B'Av, oftentimes we get very sort of sad, and we get very down about the fact that Gullus has been a long time. We sit on the floor every day, every year, every Tisha B'Av day, and we think to ourselves, when are we ever going to get the Beis Hamikdash back? It's been 2,000 years. But it's important for us to remind ourselves that the truth is that Hashem has embedded within the Gullus experience, within the reality of this difficulty, is also the reality of triumph. It's also the reality of the Tov. Just like Hashem gave us the Torah, gave us the second Dibros in recognition of the difficult reality of making mistakes, so too he gave us the opportunity of Geula within the challenge of Galus. And I think that's something very important to remind ourselves with, especially after such a long time, right? The famous saying of Napoleon, when he saw the Jews mourning on Tisha B'Av, he said, "What are these people doing?" And the story goes that someone told him that they're mourning their Beis HaMikdash. He said, "What do you mean mourning Beis HaMikdash? I don't remember any temple being destroyed recently." He said, "No, this temple was destroyed thousands of years ago." I don't know, thousands at that point. It was probably less, 2,000 years ago. But either way, so Napoleon responds, if after this many years the Jewish people are still mourning, so they'll definitely be able to see it once again. They'll definitely get it back. If this is how much they care about it, so then Hashem will definitely bring it back for them. Now, Napoleon's relationship with the Jewish people was up and down throughout history, so I'm not necessarily going to explain why he was saying that about the Jews, but either way, the statement is true, that if we're still caring about the Beis HaMikdash, we have to also know that we can get it back. There's a beautiful piece in the Eim HaBarim Smecha, Rav Teichtel, which is an unbelievable book, which I left upstairs, so I have it in English. I wanted to read it in English. But either way, he says the following, and I'll just paraphrase it a little bit here. If you think about the words galut and geula, the root of the words are very similar. Both the root of the word galut is gala, gimel lamed hay, right? And the root of the word Geula is Gimel Aleph Lamed. Both Aleph and Hey are pretty loose parts of the Shoresh, right? Hey is also always at the end of a word, and Aleph is oftentimes chopped off of a word, or it can be manipulated in some ways. So Galut, Gala, has a Hey at the end, but it has a Gimel and a Lamed, and similarly, Geula has a Gimel and a Lamed. But Ga'al, as we say in the morning before Shemona Esrei, Ga'al Yisrael, Ga'al has an Aleph in the middle. What's the difference between Galut, exile on the one hand, and Ge'ula, redemption on the other hand? So says Rav Teichtel, the difference is where the Jewish people are. Hashem, when the people are unified, when they're one, and they're brought back to the land of Israel in the times, God willing, of the Beis HaMikdash being built, so that's Ge'ula. That's when everyone's together in the middle of the world, right? Ge'ula with that Aleph, the unifying Aleph. Only one place. They're all in one place. But Ge'ula, Gimel Lamed Hey. Galut, Gimel Lamed Hey, Gala. Exile is with a Hey. What's a Hey? A Hey is where the Jewish people are on all four corners of the earth, proverbially. They're all four corners. But we know the letter Hey is not four, it's five. So says Rav Teichtel in Eim HaBarim Smecha that fifth place is right in the middle. The fifth place is the same place which is the Aleph, right? The Eretz Yisrael, the place of the Beis HaMikdash, is the Aleph where everyone's going to be unified. And even in Galus, even when it's Gimel Lamed Hey, even during the exile, that place is still already there. That place is already existent for everybody to come back to. They might be, the Jewish people might be all in all four corners of the earth, but that Aleph is still there. It's still in the middle for everybody to come back to the middle. And as we've seen in recent memory, God willing to continue, that we've already seen the return of many Jews to Eretz Yisrael. We've seen the return of many Jews to the place of the Beis HaMikdash on Tisha B'Av. We've seen people already start, right, as we say, controversially, as we say in the Mishaberach for the Jewish state, Reshit Smichat Geulatenu, whatever that means, the beginning flowering of our redemption. That's what Eim HaBarim Smecha is talking about. It's the point in the middle, that fifth point, where all the Jewish people might be on all four corners, but the fifth point is the most important one. And that's the one that everyone, even now, even in Galus, even during the Gimel Lamed Hey, the Aleph is already there. The middle point is already there for all the people to come back to. You can already make it to Eretz Yisrael. Says the Eim HaBarim Smecha, within the Galus is already a little bit of Geula. Even inside of the challenge is the opportunity to make the redemption already happen. And it reminded me of the same idea from the second Dibros, the concept of Tov, only even when We can make mistakes. Hashem is giving us a Torah that already gives us the solution to it. Even while we're in Golos, even while we're in the exile, Hashem gives us a place which is already an expression of the Geula. And that is the Aleph in the middle. He ends off with a very a sort of a touching story about Rav Menachem Mendel of Premishlan, where they were once at an inn of some kind, and they ordered a drink, and the drink cost five rubles or something, and Rav Menachem Mendel gave the waiter a 4-ruble coin, or whatever it is. He gave him a 4-ruble coin and told him that's good enough. So the waiter brought it to the back, and obviously wasn't good enough. So the waiter, you know, or the manager came back and said, you know, this is the wrong. You have to give 5 rubles for this drink. And he says the four is the same as the 5. So he said, the Talmidim, I don't know if the Talmidim paid the extra ruble or the Talmidim told the owner to not bother with it. He knows what he's doing. And in the end of the story, apparently Rav Menachem Mendel said that Emir Tashem, as you see in the last line here, Yehei Rava Shekol Bay Olam Yedu V'Yakiru. Hopefully soon everyone will know that 4 really means 5. And the intention of him saying that was to say that the fact that the Jewish people are scattered throughout all 4 corners of the earth doesn't mean that we're forever banished outside of the land of Israel. That while we're scattered all over the world, there's still that 5th spot. There's still that center. That's already the Geula in the middle between all 4 of those scattered places in the world that we've been unfortunately scattered towards. We can all come back to Eretz Yisrael. We can all come back to the center, that 5th spot, that we have to know on this Tisha B'Av that 4 really means 5. And even though it's been a long time, the Golos is already showing signs of Geula. And we have to hold on to that 5th spot. We have to hold on to that center, that Aleph, that hopefully soon will be our unifying factor for us to realize that when God gives us a challenge, He also gives us the opportunity to overcome it. And just like it's the case when it comes to Kibud Av Va'Em, when it comes to Shabbos, when it comes to the Torah, He gave us the Yetzer Hara, He gave us that opportunity or that possibility of mistake. But specifically that mistake is what allows us to do good. It's what allows us to make things better. So just like the Jewish people made a terrible mistake by the Egel Azav, that Egel Azav allowed the Jewish people to do Tov. It allowed the Jewish people to have a Torah which they can rectify their mistake with. And now Hashem gave us a galus. He gave us an existence which is unfortunately not where we want to be, but we have to know that through that challenge, through that test, the Geula is already there for us to take. So Amir Tashem and this Tisha B'Av will be back in Yerushalayim, but if not, we have to keep in mind that there's something to mourn over so that hopefully we'll be able to re-enter that stage of Geula, which is already, the opportunity is already there inside of the Galus. So I know it's somewhat of a philosophical, theological claim, but we have to sort of keep that perspective during Tisha B'Av to make sure we always keep Geula in mind and that we don't think that it's too far away and out of our reach. And we can learn that also from the way that the Aseres Sedirbos are depicted in this week's Parsha. Okay, a lot to chew on, but hopefully something to go into Tisha B'Av with and something to go into the Parsha with.